Mary, speak in the name of God, the lover, the beloved, and the love sharer.
Amen.
Despite the temptations of the gospel reading this morning, offering a number of wonderful angles for the preacher, I promised last week to talk a little bit more about Joseph. And last week, you remember, I offered a kind of 30,000-foot overview of the book of Genesis, which is the first book of the Torah and of the Christian Old Testament. It's part of what's known as the Deuteronomic Corpus, and it's composed sometime between the 7th and the 6th centuries before the Common Era. In a way, we might think of the Deuteronomists as the equivalent of the Founding Fathers, whose writings laid out the constitutional framework for a new nation emerging after the victory of the Revolutionary War. Similarly, the Deuteronomists wrote a history of Israel to cement the transition from a loose tribal confederation into a centralized monarchy. And the whole thrust of the writing of this history is through the filter of the covenant that God has made with Israel. And so the Deuteronomic history follows a pattern, with Genesis accounting for stories of origin. The book of Deuteronomy itself retells the Exodus experience again, and the books of Joshua and Judges focus on the period of Israel's conquest of the land. And the first and second book of Samuel and the first and second books of the Kings cover the period of political transition from tribal confederacy to monarchy through the period of monarchy and under David and its eventual fragmentation after the death of Solomon. And so a major theme in the Deuteronomic history is the explanation of bad events as God's punishment for infidelity to the covenant. It's like us departing from the terms of the Constitution. And we know that when we do that, bad things happen. The Deuteronomic texts were later edited, about 500 years later, by the priestly scribes, who needed to go back through them to try to find the answer that would explain the captivity in Babylon. Now, as a written text, the book of Genesis is predated by a number of oral stories. But we can think about it as divided into two parts. The first part is the great sweep from creation through the fall, the flood, and a series of other events until the arrival on the scene of Abraham. And this is a point of great transition in the book of Genesis. All the stories before Abraham are what we call myth, by which we mean they're stories that happen prior to recorded history. From Abraham through to Joseph and beyond, we then enter into the second part of Genesis, which is the story about the lives of human beings in the flow of human history. So Genesis weaves together what originally were quite unrelated oral stories, and it weaves them into a kind of family framework. Father, Abraham, son, Isaac, grandson, Jacob, and great-grandson, Joseph. Originally in the oral stories, these are coming from different parts of the Confederation, and the figures actually have very little to do with each other. But what Genesis does is it creates this family web. And we come today to the saga of Joseph, which is written in the vein of the recent HBO drama Succession. Now, who's Joseph? Well, the short answer is he's Jacob's next to youngest son, born to him in his old age by Rachel, his first and most beloved of his four wives. Put politely, Joseph is something of a teenage brat who plays on his father's favoritism to really piss his older brothers off. And to add insult to injury, as a sign of his favoritism, Jacob weaves Joseph a coat of many colors. Of course, the inspiration for Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber's wonderful musical, Joseph and His Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. The sight of Joseph preening and prancing around in his coat, the reminder of his father's favoritism, must have been a daily provocation for his brothers. And as Rice and Lloyd Webber's title hints at, Joseph was not only a prancer, but he was also a dreamer. And more precisely, the receiver and interpreter of what Carl Jung referred to as big dreams. Now, to cut a long story short, consumed with jealousy, his brothers intending to murder him threw Joseph into a dry well. But after second thoughts, they pulled him up to sell him to Midianite traders, who in turn sold him into slavery in Egypt. Through a series of events, Joseph's gift for dream interpretation enables him to climb out of slavery and to rise up on the political ladder of Egypt, and he eventually comes to the notice of the Pharaoh as the one to interpret a troubling dream that Pharaoh had about seven fat cows who devour seven skinny cows. And Joseph interprets the cows as 7 good years of harvest, followed by 7 years of famine. And much impressed, Pharaoh makes Joseph his prime minister, with the responsibility for putting into practice the dream's interpretation. And so Joseph, over 7 years, each year confiscates the vast bulk of the harvest and stores it away in great granaries, enabling Egypt to survive during the following 7 years of famine. But it's not so for Jacob and the rest of the family in Palestine. Compelled by famine, Jacob sends a delegation of his sons, all except the youngest Benjamin, down to Egypt to buy grain. And the brothers come before the prime minister as bedraggled supplicants. Now, of course, Joseph recognizes them, even though they have no idea who he is. They have no idea that he is their brother. And Joseph, the inveterate joker, plays on their ignorance, manipulating them into returning home with gifts for their father and a request to return with the youngest brother, Benjamin. And on their return, Joseph can't keep the charade up. He breaks down in front of them. And today's reading opens on this scene with Joseph revealing himself to the extreme consternation of his brothers. He cries, "I'm Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him. So dismayed were they at his presence. And they came closer. And he said, "I am Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt." Instead of savoring the moment, remember, revenge is a dish best served cold. Seeing his brother's distress, Joseph allays their fears. And he explains to them that it's not their fault, that it's all part of God's plan, sending him ahead so that he might be in a position to save the family from dying of famine. And there's much weeping and kissing and hugging to the puzzlement of all Pharaoh's household. Now, what these patriarch epics, Abraham, Jacob, and Joseph, Isaac doesn't really get an epic because he's just a bridge. We only know about Isaac because he's Abraham's son, he's Rebekah's wife, he is Jacob's father. So he bridges, he's the familial bridge. All these epics, which the Deuteronomic compilers brought together, they did so with an objective, which was to construct for the emerging nation a story of origin. And with the Joseph saga, the stage is now set for the next installment in Israel's history with Moses and the Exodus. Now, we have the advantage of psychological curiosity. For us, the patriarch stories are speaking of the enduring human nature, of personal and family tensions. Looked at from this angle, the spiritual value of the Joseph story lies in it being a study of the conflicting human emotions: favoritism, jealousy, rivalry, hatred, betrayal, revenge, and the complexities of forgiveness. Joseph, the visionary trickster, is not above playing with his brothers and making them squirm, but this is the extent of his desire for revenge. As a dreamer and interpreter of dreams, Joseph has always been able to penetrate the thin space between human perception and divine intimation. He's had time to meditate on God's larger purpose, to meditate with gratitude. And with the arrival of his brothers, this purpose is given its ultimate meaning. Now, in today's portion, we see him abandoning his game playing to reveal himself as someone who responds to memories of betrayal. He meets the impulse for revenge with forgiveness. The brothers are relieved, and yet continue nevertheless to feel disquieted because they remain stuck in a more primal stage of emotional development in which one bad turn always deserves another. In Joseph's self-revelation, they are confronted with having to process their hitherto unprocessed unconscious legacy of guilt It's hard to live with memories of the jealousy that might propel you to the murderous intent of killing your brother. And today's portion ends with the scene of tearful reconciliation. The youngest brother Benjamin has joined them in Egypt, and their ancient father Jacob will soon do so. It seems all's well that ends well. But emotions are never that simple. With Jacob's death, the final chapter of Genesis, chapter 50, verse 15, we read, realizing that their father was dead, Joseph's brothers said, "What if Joseph still bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for the wrong that we did to him?" Learning from experience does not seem to have been a skill that Joseph's brothers had acquired. They once more concoct a lie to ward off what they imagine is Joseph's desire for revenge, which is in reality the projection of their own unresolved guilt. They tell Joseph that Jacob's dying intention was to beg him to forgive his brothers. Without the benefits of modern psychological analysis, it seems that the 6th century Deuteronomists knew that it's easier to forgive than to be forgiven. More specifically, to forgive ourselves through the transformation of allowing ourselves to be forgiven. Amen.